sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Today on Rainbow Country, gay romance fiction, plus Canadian queer film at the place of ghosts. That and more next, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to Rainbow Country, as I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on Canadian gay romance fiction with author Robert Joseph Green, who joins me to talk about his latest novel, Sugar Match, How to Get a Sugar Daddy. We'll find out about Sugar Match and so much more. Plus, my interview with award-winning Canadian filmmaker Breton Hanam, who joins me to talk about his current queer film, At the Place of Ghosts, which hits Canadian cinemas on May 8th. In Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that and more lie ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning creator Tilly Bridges reads from her latest book, Begin Transmission, The Trans Allegories of the Matrix. Tracking one person's transition journey from Thomas Anderson to Neo to Trinity.
The Matrix is a confirmed and intentional trans allegory written and directed by two transgender sisters, Lily and Lana Wachowski. They weren't out as trans when the first three movies or the Animatrix were made, but publicly came out as trans before the fourth movie. This changes the context for some of the films, which we'll discuss along the way. I want to remind you that these movies are fantastic humans versus machines sci-fi movies, and that the first absolutely revolutionized action movies and special effects, and there's also entire religious and philosophical metaphors to explore. All of those things are well worth discussing. The movies are so dense and have so many layers, I'm in awe as a writer. But I'm only going to talk about the trans allegories. Please don't take that as an indication I don't think those other things exist or aren't worth discussing. It's just that these allegories are so densely packed with detail about the trans experience that it's going to take this entire book to explain them. Note that the very name, Matrix, means a set of rules and procedures that define how something works. The society we all live in is our matrix, and yes, it does have you, well, many of you. It's the cisgender binary we're all forced into at birth without our consent. It restricts us and harms us in all sorts of ways, which these movies will show you time and again. Neo's our lead, and The Matrix is about his journey in coming to terms with the fact that he's transgender. Reloaded is about all the ways society comes for you once you're out as trans, and wondering if we would have transitioned if we knew how hard life would become. Revolutions is about dealing with our own internalized transphobia and where we might be able to go in the future, or where we hope society might go. Resurrections is about detransitioning and retransitioning and the co-opting and erasure of trans voices. But we have to go in order for everything to make sense. Neo always presents as male in the movies, of course, but remember this is allegory and the first movie was also made in 1999. Here we are over 20 years later and we still don't have a transgender sci-fi action movie lead. We can't hold that against them. The surface level story is about Neo accepting that he's the one, and there will be much more on that later, but his journey is a trans one. His chosen name, Neo, literally means new. His dead name is Thomas Anderson. Thomas means twin, and Anderson means son of Andrew, and Andrew means manly or masculine. This means his name roughly translates to twin of the manly or masculine. This is your very first indicator of just how intentional these allegories are. You don't accidentally pick a name that means twin of the masculine for a trans allegory. And even if you somehow did, if that was the only evidence, then sure, maybe it's a coincidence. But it's only the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Morpheus, in mythology, is the god of dreams. In The Matrix, Morpheus is Neo's superego and subconscious, and knows of his dream to be his true self. He knows the truth about Neo and spends every movie trying to help him accept it. Cypher is Neo's id and his doubt. A cipher is literally a secret, a code that hides the truth. It plagues Neo, eating at him. His id is so sure that he's in fact not trans and would be all too happy to just never think about it again. Neo's doubt is later personified by Link and then Bugs, but those are very different kinds of doubt that we'll discuss when those characters appear. Trinity is Neo's self-actualization, the person he wishes to be. Her name alone tells you she's Neo, one, the ego, Morpheus, two, the superego, and Cypher, three, the id, all rolled into one. Trinity's in balance, in harmony, a whole person. Also note, she is a woman. The other three are men. Neo has to reconcile these supposedly male aspects of himself if he ever wants to attain self-actualization. Note how similar Neo and Trinity look, even down to their hair. None of that's by accident. Everything in a movie is a choice. And not only does this also hold through all four movies, I submit to you it is the entire point of all four movies. They tell the journey of one person, from Thomas Anderson to Trinity. Agent Smith begins as the personification of society and the passive transphobia it exhibits by designing a system, the cisgender binary, that does not even account for the existence of transgender people. Over the course of the first movie and then through the sequels, he comes to represent active transphobia, the parts of society that acknowledge trans existence, only so they can then attack it and try to make it impossible for us to exist within it. Other important things to know before we start. The Oracle is Neo's heart, later replaced by Bugs. Tank is the trans community, later replaced by Zion and then Io. Locke is Neo's fear. Niobe is Neo's confidence. And the color red is vital to understanding all four movies, wherein it stands for unequivocal truth. Know that it stands for truth now, and the explanation for why that is will come early in discussing the first movie. Blue stands for doubt, and yellow for fear. Always. The mixture of these colors is also used to convey more complex things. Purple shows you there's truth and doubt. Orange shows you there's truth and fear. The green overcast of the original trilogy shows you the world the cisgender binary matrix has created is based in fear and doubt. Yellow plus blue equals green. All agents, police, and security guards across all movies are cis white men. This is also intentional. It's showing you who benefits from the false cisgender binary, who set it up, and who extracts power from it to keep themselves at the top. This is also why the architect and the analyst are cis white men. These are the bedrock of the allegories. The foundation of everything else is built on and used to say all that the Wachowskis have to say. The good news is these are explained to you through the movies themselves. We're going to go through them all in order, Not exactly frame by frame, but it might as well be for as much as these movies have to say. To truly understand the allegories, you'll need to go in order and read them in the order written, in the order of the movie's release. Jumping ahead will only lead to confusion, so I don't recommend it. But technically you can if you want to. I mean, I'm not the boss of you. I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
When I return at the place of ghosts.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
You okay?
I saw him.
Both swore that we'd never talk about this.
If he can get to me in the city, he's already at your back door. You take care of him, and we can both get back to our own lives.
We're looking for a cave. Deep in the old forest, with petroglyphs carved into the entrance.
Majul Quatros of Cebu, Nibuk Nageginu Adulo, Dantes of Gohoi.
This place is tricky. Seen all sorts of things.
Sometimes it takes one spirit to fight another.
Everything would be okay.
Breton, hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I am well. Your current feature at the Place of Ghosts. Talk to me about this very entertaining queer horror film, and talk to me about the story that you're telling.
Yeah, it's, I always describe it as, it's just a weird movie, but it's about two estranged siblings that live very different lives, and there's this, you know, terrible dark secret, this traumatic event that has happened in their past, they're sort of haunted by, literally haunted by in this particular movie, and they have to come together, reunite for the first time in a long time in order to go to like the heart of the forest where this traumatic event happened. But it's not an ordinary forest. It's a place where sort of like time and memory are very fluid and flexible. So they end up meeting like their ancestors, their descendants, and themselves as younger people, as kids, leading up to like actually facing this traumatic event, so they can sort of repair their relationship and repair their own lives, like and begin to heal.
So talk to me about that, using flashbacks and the way that you use the flashbacks. How did that all come about? What's the origins of that?
That's a good question. I feel like there's probably 5 different answers I could give, but I'll try to sum it up succinctly into one. It's more sort of like from two places, from two main places. One is a little more off the cuff, which is, you know, what if you could meet your younger self and have a conversation with them, like sort of like what would you say? I think people think about that a lot, and I've seen it in some time travel movies, but those are sort of like, if you talk to someone, you change the past, and it becomes really focused on like time, and I'm more focused on people. So that's one place that it comes from, and the other is sort of the notion that, you know, your ancestors are behind you. All of your ancestors are behind you. They have sort of made this path that leads to you. So being able to visually enter into a space and interact with them and see them and understand them, that's sort of like the other side of the idea behind that.
The visuals in this film, it's a beautifully shot film. Again, talk to me about the origins of that, how you guys decided how you would shoot this film.
Yeah, I was very lucky in this film because the cinematographer is Guy Godfrey, and I worked with Guy on my first feature, Wildhood, or my previous feature, Wildhood. And we talked about sort of how is this different? Like, what is the visual feel? What is the language? You know, and it's a little maybe cliche to say the forest is a character. I think, you know, that that's tossed around a lot, but it's very much true. I would say the forest is in a way the heart of this film. So when we're filming it, like, there's a lot of thought that went into like just finding parts of the forest that, like, you know, you can feel that are breathing, that are alive. And then as a character in the story, the forest is sort of like bringing to these siblings the things that they need. Sometimes that's the support of their ancestors, and sometimes it's facing this trauma. But it's all sort of like a lot of time went into the location scouting to like find these like really special, secret, beautiful places.
Well said, well said. Like I just said, it's a beautifully shot film. There's one particular scene that I am personally calling Liquid Sky, and it's near the very end of the film where the two characters are in the canoe, the two brothers, and they're, no words are said, they're just in the canoe near the very end of the film. And the way that film is shot, was that shot in camera or was that done in post? Because it is beautiful.
That's all in camera. That's just a gift. That's a gift from the land.
It's called talent as well. Here's my last question for you. And it's three quick questions, essentially one word answers. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. Red or white?
Red.
Day or night?
Night.
Wildhood or at the place of ghosts?
Oh, that's a mean one. That's like choosing a favorite child.
Both.
I would say both. Both. Yes. Very different children, but I love them both.
Bretton and Nam, thank you so much for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Congrats.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
We're closed. Sir, are you okay?
I saw him.
Both swore that we'd never talk about this.
If he can get to me in the city, he's already at your back door. We take care of him, and we can both get back to our own lives. We're looking for a cave deep in the old forest with petroglyphs carved into the entrance.
Majul Quatos of Sibu. Nibuk Nagenginu Adulot Dantes of Gohoi.
This place is tricky. Seen all sorts of things.
Sometimes it takes one spirit to fight another.
Ah!
Everything would be okay.
At the Place of Ghosts hits Canadian cinemas starting May 8th. Up next, a spotlight on gay romance fiction.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Robert Joseph Green. Hello. Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? And thanks for having me.
I am well, first of all. And thank you for being here. I appreciate your time and your talent and your energy. Okay. You are an author of gay romantic fiction, a Canadian author of gay romance fiction. You have a release coming out in 2026 called Sugar Match, How to Get a Sugar Daddy. Talk to me about this particular book and what is Sugar Match all about?
Well, there's an interesting backstory to that. When I was in New York, I actually met a gentleman who was in New York high gay society, and he sort of had I don't want to say a reputation. He's known for connecting very wealthy gay men with their ideals or their ideal matches. And we got into a really interesting conversation over it. The topic was that, you know, everyone wants a sugar daddy, but they don't really know what's entailed in those sort of relationship dynamics. And he basically said, you know, when he talks to people, especially younger men, he has some key points that he tries to extract from them to get an understanding of who they are. And he said 90% of those he talks to, he kind of, you know, disqualifies them because the understanding of what your relationship is with a sugar daddy is varied, true, but his interest is for his clients. And he says, if you have that understanding, then, you know, we'll move forward. But he wants to know if that understanding is natural, meaning he's not going to prod them saying you have to behave this way. He talks to them and engages in them in a way that sort of sees if they have the ability to do that. And it was the most interesting and most dynamic conversation I had in my life, and it always stayed in my head. So now, I should say this was many, many years ago, and through the grapevine, since I'm not a direct friend of his, my understanding is he has passed away. So I'm sort of legally safe from that frame point. There was a fear that if I told this story and told his sort of philosophy or guidelines that I might be liable. But since that is no longer a business that he's running, I felt a little more on the safe end to publish what the discussion was, and it's in the book. Although I make the book a fiction story, the conversation I had, now the character in the book's name is Seymour. The character Seymour is this person who goes out and, you know, scouts men, and I shouldn't say young men all the time. There just might be a particular man that might be older, you know, for these sort of relationships. And, you know, the other thing is that I'm actually known for my Gay Icon Classics of the World 1, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And those are love stories from different cultures from around the world. And when I first wrote about them, I chose cultures that were primarily homophobic. But what's interesting is that in these stories, there's a sliver of truth in them. So I'm going to give you the perfect example. The Journey in the Jewels, which takes place in Saudi Arabia, that is based on an Arabic poet named Abu Nuwas. And back, I think, in the Middle Ages, his mother was so poor that she sold him into slavery. And apparently, he was so beautiful with long, waving hair and stuff. His cousin, who was a military soldier, found him and bought him out of slavery. And he became a very famous poet. And he wrote very, very gay, erotic poems. The sad part about that is everyone knows about Abu Nuwas. If you go into any Arabic literature class in the Middle East, they'll talk about him. But they do not mention his gay poems. And that's the sad part. So I'm sort of enshrining him in a story so that we don't forget people do try to erase our past and our pasts are real. A lot of us, you know, we hear these fairy tale love stories. We actually have them. They're just not spoken about, you know. So this was a way for me to get out there that, you know, there is gallantry, there is chivalry in gay love, and it has been in a historical context. And this helps people, you know, with relationships. So I really set out to show gay men that it is true you can have a romantic, loving relationship, and we have had them historically. And they're really good feel-good stories, but they all have moral lessons to them.
Well done. Well done to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so getting back to Sugar now. There's an old saying. Write what you know. So here's the question. Have you ever had a sugar daddy? Have you ever been a sugar daddy? Or maybe you've been a sugar baby? Have you ever had that experience?
That is a very good question.
And one that you're not going to answer?
No. You know what, Mark? You'll get viewers when I tell this story, because this story is, but I'm not going to use names, all right? But I'm going to tell you a story, and it's, I think you'll understand these types of stories too, being a person of color, or mixed race, sorry. So many, many years ago, I lived in Beverly Hills with my cousin, Carmen McRae, who was one of the world's greatest jazz singers. And a lot of my friends knew I had a famous cousin who was one of the top 10 greatest jazz vocalists in the world. And she and I had a lovely relationship, you know. And I got to run in circles of, you know, a lot of well-established gay men. And one day, a friend of mine approached me saying, you know, I have this friend in Holland. He's an heir, and we were similar in age, so there wasn't an age disparity, and he's into men of color. However, his mother is, you know, although she's accepting that he's gay, she just didn't like the quality of men that he was bringing to her. And I think she sort of put her foot down saying, you know, bring me someone now and stop playing around, you know, or your inheritance is in question. I don't know the details of that. I just know that this person said, you know, could I, you know, introduce you? And he sent a photo, and this guy was gorgeous, and I could see why he's a player, you know. I was like, so he was very charming on the phone and very nice, and he flew me out to the Netherlands. And I was really enjoying his company. I was enjoying his charm. I was enjoying the attention. And I think he felt like, okay, this is a guy I could bring to mother, but this is also a guy I would like, you know? I flew back. At that time, I was living in California. And I flew back and, you know, we were exchanging emails and phone conversations stuff. And I flew a second time. And on the second time, We went to Amsterdam. So he lives in Rotterdam, but Amsterdam's kind of the gay Mecca. And we went out dancing and stuff. And one evening while we're at a club, he had gone to the bathroom. And one of the bartenders motioned me over. And he said, hey, and he goes, stay away from, I don't know you, but I'm going to give you some advice. Stay away from that guy. And I said, well, okay, that's kind of concerning. And I was like, he's coming back soon, and I'd like to get the backstory about him. And he says, well, I'm here from this time to this time, so anytime he could pop in, we can talk about it, right? The irony is that guy is a friend on my Facebook now. He's a very close friend of mine, and he's Belgian. He's not Dutch. Flemish Belgian. They speak, Flemish is very similar to Dutch. So anyway, I did have an opportunity where he had to do something, this guy I was sort of seeing. And so I popped back into that nightclub and I spoke to him. He goes, yeah, he has a reputation of promising the world to these African men, flying them up, having, wonderful sex with them, telling them that they're a man of his dreams, and then sending them out to go get something. And they would come back to the apartment to see their suitcases at the door saying, you have less than 12 hours to get to the airport. I'm not interested in you. Goodbye. And I was like, oh, So I went and told my friend this, and he said, yeah, it's kind of true. He kind of has a reputation like that. And I was like, well, why would you get me into a situation like this, So I realized very early on, these sort of scenarios are not for me. I wasn't looking for a sugar daddy. I wasn't, but this opportunity came on, and, now I understand these aspects of it. Fortunately, and I'm not joking, his mother died. So he got the inheritance there anyway, and he had no use for me whatsoever. So that sort of went wayside. So yes, I have had a situation where there was a very large income disparity between a person I dated and myself, and that scenario would have probably been a sugar daddy scenario.
So do you think that experience that you just shared with us, do you think that informed your writing of Sugar Daddy?
I would say the character Seymour was more aligned to why I wrote it than my experience with this gentleman. Because my experience, on one hand, I think yes, because what I know about sugar daddy situations, it's very word of mouth. So if you can't find a Seymour, it's in the social circles that you run in. When I lived in Toronto, I knew of gentlemen that had sugar daddy set up situations. And again, it was in a format where you had a social circle, and the younger guys who had befriended these established men sort of knew what their tastes were and say, oh, hey, I had this friend. And they would have this conversation, hey, this guy is interested in you, but, you have to understand him and his mannerisms. So, yes, my interactions with this Dutch gentleman did sort of influence it, but it was more in the social circles in my lifetime that I've seen that I thought was very compelling for a story to be written.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Terra for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So Robert Joseph Green, you are a Canadian writer of gay romance fiction. You are part of the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. You're a person of color. You're also married. Talk to me about when you got married. When did you get married? When did this happen?
So it actually happened last year. So we just celebrated our 1 year anniversary, August 6th. His name is David Green Evans. He's in the Canadian military. The sweetest guy you ever want to meet. He's from Kamloops, BC. He flew down for Gay Pride. We met during Gay Pride, and it was just love at first sight. The sweetest guy I could ever imagine. And, you know, we've been together 2 years, but we've been married for one.
You were born in America. I believe you grew up in what, in Flushing, New York?
Yes, Flushing, New York, yes.
And
all right, here's a side note that you're not going to like. I went to Kew Forest in Forest Hills, New York, or Kew Forest, New York. I think it's Forest Hills. That's the same high school Donald Trump went to.
Well, there you go.
My embarrassing claim to fame.
So you were born in America. You're now living in Canada, in BC. Mm-hmm. But growing up in America, mm-hmm. did you, in the back of your mind, at one time think that you would be able to marry the man of your dreams growing up in America at the time that you did?
I think I was hopeful. You know, I think every guy I met, in the back of my mind, being a romantic as I was, I was like, yeah, you know, is this guy marriage material? You know, yeah, and gay marriage did not exist. But at the time,
and that's my point. Like, did you think that something that did not exist, that was not legal, was that you would be able to achieve that?
Yeah, that's a good question, by the way. And I'm going to answer it, Mark, in a way that I think everyone will understand. I don't believe that a marriage certificate is the relationship. Okay, the relationship is you and your partner. And where I'm basing that on is apartheid in South Africa. I have met people whose parents were mixed race They could not get married, but they still move forward forming a family in a loving household. So again, marriage isn't the be-all and end-all. You can have a loving long-term relationship and not get married. So I think at that age, I was hopeful about gay marriage. And I think there were a lot of places that had domestic partnerships and cohabitation agreements that included same-sex people. So yes, I was hopeful. But when marriage came about, I was all for it. So very happy about that.
Mm. You've written over 8 books now. Mm-hmm. And here's my question to you. What led you to write about gay romance fiction? Why this particular category?
I love that question. I'll tell you why. It's my favorite question. Because going back to as I was growing up, I think in heterosexual society, the fairy tales kind of put the blueprint on how to, for heterosexuals, for romantic love. And I didn't see that for gay men. I saw sex. I saw, a very sexualized way. But I saw a desire in men wanting gay romantic relationships, but not knowing how. So I always felt like, well, let me give you the blueprint in seeing romanticism in your personal life through these love stories.
So then, because growing up, I didn't see any of those, same-sex romantic relationships. So then when and where did you come up with those ideals?
I researched them. All of my stories, like I said, have backstories, and I had to piece together the stories to bring them out. And I'm still finding them, which is funny. I'm going to kind of segue into this current issue that I kind of got myself in the middle of. Recently, I found a love relationship between Zeno, the philosopher Zeno, and one of his students, I think his name is Petraeus, and Zeno is the founder of Stoicism, which is a very, very popular sort of philosophical dogma that people follow. And Stoicism basically is about accept what you can control and accept what you cannot, which is more aligned with Buddhism. But one of the things that, which is funny because I wrote a poem called From a Flower Wilting to a Flower Blooming. And it was a story, which is the age-old story where you have a teacher and a student, and the student falls in love with you. The teacher explains, why that love cannot be. Now, back in the day, with Zeno's time, it was because, you got to go find a wife, and populate the polis, which is the Greek society, and that's why you have it. In today's society, I think the interpretation is, if you're older, is it fair of you to hold someone that is young through your dying years while they have their, their peak years together? So an older person might say today, I do love you, but, I'm getting to an age where I will need more care and need more, attention for my health. And I don't think that's fair to you. And it's up to the younger to accept or deny that, So that's the foundations. In Stoicism, humility is a virtue. So when Zeno gave this talk to his student, he's like, look, you'll find better than me. Go out, get married, have kids. You'll find a better love than me. And that, in Zeno's eye, is humility, But is it true? And that's what happened. This is the true story. Zeno died, and Petraeus realized Zeno was wrong. His teacher, who he believed forever, was wrong. There was no greater love than Zeno. He still loves Zeno. So, you know, the philosophers these days are like, oh, you know, Robert Joseph Greene's discovered the flaw in Stoicism. We have to flush this out now. So there's an article going about me in Philosophy Now, and I have to defend my situation, which I wasn't really prepared to do. That wasn't the point. It was just, you know, a romantic poem, and I don't write poetry. So, yes, I go and research stories that are in cultures that are primarily homophobic, but not always. And another example I can give you, when I was doing summer school at UCLA, I met a young lady from the Ivory Coast, and she spoke French, I spoke French, so we kind of got, and we were in the same class, and I told her I was gay, and she said she didn't know any gay people. And then one day she came back and she said, you know what, I vaguely remember my grandmother telling me a story about two boys that were run out of the village for kissing. And that is the foundational story for the soiled loincloth, and that's another short story. So yes, that's how I came to the formulation for a majority of the stories, that they're based on truth that we just didn't know about. And then I expand upon them into a fiction story so that, you know, gay men can see that love does exist, it can grow, and it is real.
So to dovetail on what you were just talking about, your writings have sparked everything from heartfelt fan letters to being banned by a publishing company owned by the Vatican in Germany. So why were you banned by a German publishing company? What's the story behind this?
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, in that situation, it made me a lot of money. I'm going to be honest.
Okay.
My books are published in German. There's a German Wikipedia page. So it, you know, it came at the perfect market. Whereas Russia, as you know, that situation, I don't have any books there. So I didn't really profit from the publicity of, you know, Putin trying to point to my works as being the reason why they need anti-gay propaganda laws. But Germany, it's actually the German archdiocese that owned Weltbild, and it's not a public, well, it is a publishing house, but it's mainly a distribution, a book distribution company that kind of rivals Amazon, but they're kind of like the Amazon of Europe because they cover so many different countries. But it's 100% owned by the archdiocese, which is owned by the Vatican. They basically, they did a little shady practice, but I'm not going to get into that. But what I will say, in my opinion, allegedly a shady practice, they told us basically that my books, this is a Catholic-owned company, and that my books promote homosexuality, and there's no fit for them there. Well, the mistake they made is two things. One, Germans hate hypocrisy. They absolutely, as a culture, they hate hypocrisy. And Weltbild was selling softcore porn like 50 Shades of Grey, but, you know, throwing my books out. So that was the first thing, the mistake they made. The second thing, the mistake that they made was they made it public, you know, and Germans just rallied and boycotted, and it was just a crazy time. And even the German government got involved, where, you know, the ambassador of Canada from Germany, you know, wrote a letter saying this is being very much discussed. And I was on Deutsche Welle, I was on TV or radio interviews. The irony is I had to get up at 2 a.m. to do these interviews, which was not fun. But so, yeah, and the long and the short of it is that they actually went into insolvencies because, you know, not only that, they were just transitioning to an electronic system. And, you know, to have this boycott just really ruined everything. So they went into insolvency. I think the Catholic Church was like, look, we got to offload this because this is, you know, this is costing us money. And so I think it got sold to another entity who's been wonderful with me. They're like, you know, whatever books you have, just send them over. You know, let's bury the hatchet. So it did have a happy ending. But yes, that was kind of a controversial situation. Now, I want to point out, if I may, we my publisher, Icon Empire Press, did have a conversation with someone from, I believe, the Archdiocese as to particularly why my books, you know, why were you going after me? And Mark, I think you're going to find this interesting. I wrote a book called The Forbidden Scrolls, and it's based on Lucian of Samosata. He was an orator back in the Roman era, and he had a great debate. And I'm going to turn this back on you, Mark. His debate was, which is better for man, the love of a man or the love of a woman? All right, so that was the debate. Who do you think won that debate, Mark?
The love of a man or the love of a woman?
Who is greater for a man, the love of a man or the love of a woman?
I would say probably the love of a woman, because it would probably relate to like a mother figure or something.
Mark, scandal. Shame on you. Actually, it was the love of a man.
Oh, yes.
So now you have to understand why I got in so much trouble, because the Roman Catholic Church said they saw this debate. It's a very well-known debate. It's called erotes. And they're like, we need to seal this discussion away. All right, pronto. And they have a thing called the Index, and it's the list of forbidden reading. It's been around since the 1500s or 1300s, I don't remember. So Catholics are forbidden to read this. So I based a love story on a scribe who actually could read what he was writing, and, you know, the owner of the kingdom hired him and shared this with him, and they fell in love because it was forbidden, and then they escaped, you know, because they got found out that they were gay lovers. And the Vatican didn't like that. They didn't like that. There were certain translations of that book, of Erote. So you could get it in Spanish. You could get it in English. But you couldn't get it in German. And my German translation was out there, and they didn't want that. So they wanted that book pulled. And we believe that, allegedly, was the reason why they selected me to not be on their roster at Weltbild.
Wow. Well done to you. So I just have a couple minutes left with you. Here's my last question. And it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've experienced your writings, essentially after they've experienced Robert Joseph Greene? What do you hope your audiences come away with?
Well, as you know, my writings, illegally in Chinese, by the way, in Mandarin, I believe. So they like it so much, they bootlegged it. Because I have a Wikipedia page in Chinese about my work that I have no Chinese translation. So I get fan mail in Chinese on my author's, I love your stories. And I'm like, I'm not making any money off of that. But all the other languages, my hope and dreams are you read the story and you're like, I want that. I want that kind of love. And you share that story with your partner, someone you're dating or someone you've met. And they want that sort of love too. And that is your blueprint for forming a loving, lasting relationship. Now, I do want to add, Mark, if you look at the historicals of marriage, we now have, 10, 15 years of marriage history. When gay marriage was being legalized, divorce lawyers were promoting it like no tomorrow. Yes, 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 because they thought they hit the jackpot. They thought gay men would get married and divorce like crazy. No. The statistics are out. We actually, between heterosexual marriage, lesbian marriage, and gay marriage, we have the lowest divorce rate on all of those. So, you know, Lucian of Samosata was right. Ultimately, the love of a man is possibly the best form of love that a man can give.
Hey. I have to say, Robert Joseph Greene, well said, well done, well written. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. And really, thank you for having me. I really applaud you opening the eyes of our community to the possibilities and positive efforts of life in being with our culture.
That was my spotlight on gay romance fiction featuring Canadian author Robert Joseph Greene. Sugar Match, How to Get a Sugar Daddy, is available wherever you get your favorite books, including Amazon.ca.
Hi, this is Claudia Barry, and you're listening to Mark Tara on Rainbow Country.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. 1985's Call It Love from Canadian new wave group Images in Vogue.
Live music fans, get ready. Spring Reverb returns for its fifth edition May 28th through the 31st in downtown Kingston, Ontario, and CFRC is thrilled to be part of the action. Over 4 days, you can catch live music panels, workshops, and see what makes the Kingston music scene tick. Get ready for acts like Bedouin Soundclash, The Dirty Nil, Hot Garbage, By Divine Right, Slaves of Spanky, Pony Girl, Tanya Iyer, Golden Feather, and so much more. Also make sure to check out all the free panels, workshops, a merch market, and the first ever Cataraqui Punk Rock Flea Market. For more information on the lineup and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com or Spring Reverb YGK on socials. See you there.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.